You know what? Eat all the time you want. I'll get it back. Because you're not real. Nothing that hurts me is real. No one who hates me is real. As of God. Well, listen to this. You want to eat something? Eat shit. Now go tell your friends it's not your time, it's mine. Go. Or I kill every one of you.
Hey, everybody, welcome to our podcast. I'm Jason.
And I'm Rima.
And I'm Aaron.
And this is the Legion Podcast, episode 23. All right, I think we covered it. Time for the news. Just kidding. What did you just say?
Time error. The temporal corruption.
Wait.
Somebody's eating some time.
That would make things a lot easier.
just add those clock sounds. A clunk. And
yep.
We're done.
All right, so it's our top three highlights for Legion season 3, episode 4, chapter 23. Rima, what'd you think?
I really liked it. Yeah, I thought it was really great. I loved the horror element that we got with those time demons. I thought that was pretty cool. Yeah, I think this one definitely set a few things forward. I mean, it kind of, I don't want to say stuck in time. I feel like they said time so many times during that episode, but there was a little bit of forwarding the plot a little bit, like with Carrie, but I really liked kind of the peeling of the layers that we got of a couple of the characters. And again, just like the horror, I liked it, that because I don't know that we got a lot of that with Legion before.
This definitely felt like the most like a horror movie to me. And as far as the plot, I mean, basically it seems to me that the time demons are out of the picture, but now Switch may have gone over to the other side, and that's kind of it for as far as, but yeah, this show is much more experiential than plot oriented, I would say. It's both, but anyway.
Yeah.
Aaron.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I was a little skeptical of the design of these things when I first saw them, but the way they moved was so just inherently creepy and menacing that it actually reminded me in the kind of like the low budget, this shouldn't work, but it does kind of way that the Weeping Angels do Doctor Who. Yeah, just that they're like, it's something that you've never seen before, and it's there's a sense of inevitability. That no matter how fast or well hidden you are or sly, that they can find you wherever they are because they have control of time.
Yeah.
That plus their kind of minimalist design, their glowing eyes, and the way that sometimes like when they'd freeze frame, their eyes would like be streaked and blurry. I thought it was just really, really excellent horror, and they hit that also with some emotional horror, like the whole experience that Lenny goes through with the birth and life cycle of her child.
Oh yeah,
really some just existential horror and dread, and very, very emotionally effective.
I thought it was great. It was, I love how even though the first two episodes of this season were kind of similar, that since then, well, we've only had two more, but they've both been pretty drastically different and also pretty different from, I mean, I just love how the show can pick a new tone for an episode and this was the horror episode, and I just thought it was really interesting and innovative. And you know, the time demons are sitting there giggling about how they're fucking with everybody, and I also feel like that was the writers, just how can we play with time that in the most horrific way, you know. So
for sure.
So I thought it was great. Okay. And the look of them, I thought of the Weeping Angels, and also I don't know if you guys saw this, but there was that old Beatles movie cartoon, The Yellow Submarine, and there were
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Have you seen that, Rima?
No.
Oh, well, there's this creature that is basically a blue glove flying around, but it has big teeth and it smiles all the time in a creepy way, and it's malevolent, so it kind of reminded me of that too. Anyway, okay, let's get into the top three. Rima, what's your number three?
My number three, I'm going to start with David. I really liked that scene when Lenny, after she comes to get him, when he's in his, like, I guess, like, this meditative state where he's, like, floating or whatever, and he goes upstairs and he's talking with his followers. I was really creeped out by them calling him Daddy. I don't like that. I don't get it. So I was kind of just...
Daddy's had a hard day.
Yeah, it's just... I don't get calling adults and someone who's not your dad, Daddy, whether it's in a sexual kind of nature or whatever was happening here. I don't know, but I don't like it. So that was a little bit of a turnoff. But
yeah,
just kind of icked out. Like, oh, okay, I don't. Please stop saying Daddy. They just kept saying it over and over again. But when I got past that, I thought it was just an interesting exchange, because we haven't really seen, I don't think we've really seen him interact with his followers much, right? He's always kind of off doing his thing, mm-hmm. in his meditative state. He's, teleporting somewhere else or an astral plane or projecting himself somewhere, and you haven't really seen him interact with them much. So we actually got a little bit of interaction, and, he puts them in this drug-induced haze because they're asking for it or whatever. And then Lenny comes at him, wanting, and he's like, he tells her, he's like, if you can't be nice, I can't be nice. And I thought that was kind of interesting, because I think we're starting to kind of see that faux exterior that he has up kind of start to slip away. And you kind of see that, interior of what's happening inside of him with, because he's so full of hurt and anger and self-justification. And I think we're starting to see glimpses of that. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And I like when he says, he's like, you want honest, here's honest. I'm going to fix this, whatever it takes, whatever the universe throws at me. Division 3, time demons, send them all. I'll slay them all, because this is my time. This is David's time. And I think that anytime someone starts referring to themselves in the third person, you should start to worry a little bit. So I really like that exchange.
Aaron strongly agrees with what you just said.
Yeah, Daddy over here, he's, yeah, totally.
There's a lot of, like, if we didn't have any other inclinations, like the title that he bestows upon himself, the Alpha and the Omega, which is a biblical title for God, and I think also Jesus Christ, or if you're Trinitarian, one and the same. But I think it was interesting that his mother, when he's talking to her in that Nazi prison cell, he asks her, what is this? And she says it's the beginning of the end, which is kind of another way to say the Alpha and Omega. So
yeah.
I thought it was interesting how they're playing with that, like, even in the dialogue, that his grandiose title is also Harbinger of Doom.
Mm-hmm. I feel like this episode, it reminded me of Breaking Bad, because I'm rooting for David, but this is the episode where I'm like, nah, I don't think I like him anymore. And I definitely got to that point with Walter White at some point during Breaking Bad, and the whole Daddy thing, and just he doesn't give a shit about Switch and whether she's hurt. He kind of goes, oh yeah, yeah, I see it's taking its toll, but we gotta keep going. Mm-hmm. And he's really fragile with Lenny. He's like, you gotta be careful with me, be nice. And you can tell his ego is really fragile, and he's dangerous because of that. I mean, he's basically got this classic nice guy persona where he projects being nice, but it's totally a facade, and underneath is just a lot of fragility. And the problem is, I mean, when he's with his mother, or what you thought was his mother, he doesn't even care about her problems, which are pretty big. It's all about the Holocaust, and he's all, no, it's not about that. It's about me. And so he's just really caring about himself and nobody else, but he's also not taking any responsibility. He just wants to go back in time and erase what happened. And he says, I'm not crazy. Something was taken from me. My life was taken from me. So it's a whole victim mentality. And Joanna Robinson from, what does she write for?
Vanity Fair.
She called him a transgressor who refuses to look inward. And I just think that's his fatal flaw. He won't look inward. He's a victim. He's got this victim mentality. And the way that he could save himself right now, whether or not, I mean, yeah, our past, sometimes things happen to us that shape us that weren't our fault, but then you got to work with what you've got. So if he would just decide, okay, what is going on with me right now? What do I need to do to fix it? Versus let me go make it so that the Shadow King never entered me, then he could potentially move forward. But it looks like he's not going to do that.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what's propelled him, you know, ever since the whole breakdown in last season is that whole mentality and how, why he feels justified in his actions.
Yeah. So. And it's, you know, thinking back when he was first taken to Summerland and the first thing they did was start going into his mind and into his memories and things. And they were trying to do that work back then. Mm-hmm. And he was open to it, but now, I mean, he's feeling like he was betrayed by them, which he sort of was. So, maybe they should have approach that in a different way versus just like trapping him there, you know, at the end of season two. But now he's like, no way. He's totally got his defenses up. Anyway, that's not even my number three. My number three is actually, Aaron, what's your number three?
Are these in supposed to be reverse order of like, are these just in any arbitrary order?
Arbitrary.
Okay, cool. Because yep. I was worried that I was like stealing, like, oh, if I just take the bet. Okay, anyway. Lenny's Baby Girl, one violence lollipop busker. I could not believe how emotionally affecting that this scene was and how well Aubrey Plaza sold it, because they mm-hmm. kind of started with like, oh, you know, there's these two women and they're in some sort of gay relationship and they're somehow pregnant. And, you know, it's like, oh, we're two girls and we'll make a girl. And it's kind of like not lighthearted, but a little like there's a little bit of absurdist or dream logic to it. And then you start realizing that Lenny's taking this really seriously. Like she gives the whole, I'm just 2 weeks until retirement kind of speech, you know, until we blow this popsicle stand. And I started thinking, oh boy, this is going to be bad. But I didn't expect the badness to come into in like the full realization, like, I don't even know how to describe that sequence, that she had like the full realization and weight of what it's like to love and care for a child until they're dead. Like I wasn't sure if like when they eat time, that just means a time's jump, but like all those events transpire, or like the fact that like it just jumped into time and like Lenny sees this new development and it's all that stuff is gone. Like Ptolemy says that all these data is just gone in a blink. Like, mm-hmm. is that what was happening in between these like milestones that Lenny was waking up for, or rejoining the time stream for? And then at the end, she's left with the drawing that her daughter gave and this pile of dust representing, you know, we saw what happened to the apple, right? And, you know, it's Lenny's always been kind of a weird funhouse character that I find it very hard to like kind of like care about her or even treat her as a real character, but she's always been really fun, and this is the first time she's actually made me feel something like this. And I thought it was just an amazing piece of writing. It was amazing conceptually. It reminds me of like an old Ray Bradbury story or something, some kind of weird 6-page short in a science fiction novel anthology. And man, just it's a damn shame more people don't watch the show, so it would get more kind of like mainstream awards and support, because the actors on the show are just doing incredible work.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Noah Hawley wrote, and did he direct, Rima, this new movie coming out?
Yes.
What's it called? Lucy in the Sky. And I think Dan Stevens stars, and so does Princess Amidala.
Natalie Portman.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. The only reason why I bring that up is hopefully that'll at least get this team some attention, because he deserves it.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
But yeah, what did you think about that whole sequence, Rima?
I thought it was very heartbreaking. I'm right on board with what Aaron said. Everything that you said was, you know, right on par with my thought. I always kind of felt the same about Lenny. She was super fun, had some cute lines. You know, it was always, you know, kind of keeping, you know, things interesting on the side, but never really took her that seriously until this moment. And she, gosh, Aubrey Plaza really brought it in that whole sequence, and seeing her how she was acting with, you know, she here's one minute she's holding her baby, and then that baby's a little girl, and then a teenager, and then an adult with a baby of her own. And, you know, Lenny this whole time's like, what the hell, you know, and then tries to even escape. and then seeing her daughter as an older woman. And it was interesting that her daughter seemed to really favor her, too. Which is kind of weird, because again, like we're all kind of like...
Because we know her mom was drinking that orange soda that was really alcohol and just totally fucked up, right?
Yeah.
If I remember right. So it's I think the implication was that she would have gone the other way and been a good mom.
Yeah. It was really heartbreaking and it really emotional. And it was like she just felt this whole lifetime of pain. You know, in just moments, in a moment's time, it was this whole lifetime. And you could see how deeply it cut her there at the end when she's kind of, you know, writhing on the ground and David comes up to her and he wants to help her by kind of just making it go away, wants to kind of wipe her memory. And she says, no, I need to feel it. And that really kind of sent me over. I was like, oh, man, you know,
she's tired of, she's had enough of him. And feels like, I think she deals with him the same way she does drugs. You know, drug is an escape, but she doesn't want to escape this. And I think that's the whole point that she, I guess, I mean, I'm just kind of guessing, but this family is important to her. She says, I've got a family to protect to David. I mean, she'll even stand up to him and he's fucking scary. But that, but I think that is the point, that up until now, she's been kind of entertaining and more of an antagonist to poke at other people on the show, but they wanted to give something to make us care about her, which worked. And so they did that by having her care about this family. And so I think the heartbreak of this whole sequence is, for one thing, just overwhelm at all these things coming so fast, but also, yeah, that she missed it, that she, you know, missed all these things that are really important to her and now they're gone and it's gone and she didn't get to experience it. I think that's the reason why she was so anguished at the end there.
Yeah, it seems like she's just outgrown David. Like her realization that I have to feel this to process it is something, you know, like Joanna mentioned, you know, there's something that a transgressor who can't look inward, that's something that he denies the reality. Anything that hurts me, it's not real.
You're right.
Anything that hates me, it's not real. It's like this like narcissistic delusion that he's trapped into. And it's also... But it's also like a coping mechanism. Like, I mean, it's like that's the thing that's like, it's hard to write off David completely because he's come by all this pathos, honestly. And, you know, despite his best efforts, it's like he had the deck stacked against him. But for whatever reason, he's just not willing to open himself up to, you know, let a little bit more hurt in, to realize that you've let your friends down, the people that you love down, that you've hurt them, and hurt them in such a way that maybe there's no going back. But, you know, you have to pick yourself up and resolve to do better and you know, sin no more. He's just not capable of that introspection for whatever reason.
I mean, soul searching is painful. Taking responsibility is painful, and when he has such power, it's so easy to do something else instead, you know, to control the people around you and manipulate reality and all this to escape the truth of your situation. I mean, people who don't have any power have hard enough time deciding, okay, I'm going to take responsibility for my actions and try to change. I mean, that's most people never do that.
Much less with super mutant powers.
Okay, I think we all did our number threes, right? So we're on your number two, Rima.
Oh, okay. So my number two. We've already talked a little bit about the time demons, but they really creeped me out. I really loved, you know, they were very unsettling for me. They're like two big grins, those really big creepy grins when they would get really up close to someone, was very unsettling. They're like blurred out kind of bodies. Like you could never really kind of tell what form they really had, because they were, sometimes they kind of look like they could stand up like a human, but yet they were crouched down. And then I think when we first saw them, like when they first realized they were there, when David was talking to Switch and Lenny, and they start coming like down the stairs, and she's like, I don't know, I think they look like cats. Well, that's what you kind of think, or what I thought I was seeing on like coming down the stairs. I was like, oh gosh, they are kind of like cats, but they seemed to take some other forms, and it was just unsettling not knowing for sure exactly what kind of form that they had. Their jittery movements that were kind of set to the sound of a clock. Oh, that was really creepy and really, really effective to show how when they would move and with the timing of the clock, it you could kind of see how it was like affecting time. It was kind of letting you know that every time that they moved, it's like they were messing with time. So I thought it was really interesting how they used that. I think that they're so brilliant in explaining things to you and making it visually pleasing and not over-explaining, just kind of putting it out there and saying, this is what we're doing, and you get it without it being like in your face. And I really like that. And I was trying to kind of make a tally of what they could actually do. And we saw that they could trap people in like this mental prison. They did that with Sydney, and then they did it with David. They were able to inflict pain with their memories or their confrontations. I guess they weren't really memories, but you know, they could confront them with images of their past. And I guess they turned people to ash. But I was kind of curious as to why it seemed kind of almost random, because they got, some of David's cult people, some of his followers or whatever.
Maybe
you want to call
like
them.
Maybe it's like the apple just rapidly
that's
aging
what I,
them.
Yeah, I rapidly thought this is like, yeah, like getting the full Last Crusade treatment in like a blink of an eye. You just go from ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
Okay, well, that makes a little bit more sense. Because
we saw Salmon. We actually got to see Salmon get eaten. Like, just as she hands the baby to Sid, she disappears and leaves like a little pile of dust. And then when Violence Olipop grows into an old woman and dies, it leaves Lenny cradling this pile of dust with her picture. So I think that's the inferencers. And they kind of visually taught us that with the apple, I think.
Wait, who's Salmon?
That's Lenny's girlfriend. Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was new Janine, but she's also Salmon.
Switch called her Salmon in season one.
Okay.
They said, "Here, you're looking for Salmon."
Okay. Yeah. That's why they're okay. I didn't understand. I like that little free form association. Oh, another fish like salmon. Oh, salmon's a color. How about violet? How about violence?
Yeah.
Okay, Aaron.
I would like to talk about what a terribly refined but badass monster that Farouk is in this episode.
he's
so suave and cool. Yeah. Like the first time
he's a
where
hero.
He just I think it's probably because again, I think we're gonna find out that he's the puppet master behind all this stuff and it's suiting his purpose. But yes, like just how kind of like fearless and powerful and cool. Like even like David struggles this time demon and Farouk just like rips one of their arms off and banishes him. And then that moment, which we could talk about the time between time and what a stunning sequence that is. But when the rest of team time between time is getting kind of their asses handed to him, he like whistles and then pulls a sword out of his mouth and lays down the law. It's just and he just looks so cool doing it, too. This is kind of like they can play in this lane with David, too, where it's like, as you were saying, it's kind of Walter White, because even the very final episode of Walter White, even though I was definitely turned against him at that point, he did pull off some pretty sweet shit.
Absolutely.
Like the stuff with the laser pointer, the trunk machine gun. And like I was still capable of appreciating like you're a monster, but you're kind of magnificent, too.
Yeah,
and
you're really good at it.
Right. And it was still complicated with him because, not to get too much into Breaking Bad, but he was doing what he thought he needed to do for his family. So even though you're kind of like, okay, you're beyond redemption, I still had a soft spot for him to a degree. And I feel like that with David, too, is where it's relevant here. Even though I'm like, okay, maybe you're past the point of no return, he's still like Lenny, you know, Lenny's... challenging him, and he's like, hey, you better be careful with me, and she's not careful, she just doubles down on it, and then he goes, okay, all right, I'm gonna fix it. So he doesn't it looked like he had to struggle not to like turn her into a toad or something, but he did. He struggled with it and he didn't turn her into a toad, and so it's still not black and white with him anyway. Sorry, I cut you off.
And I just think that like it's such amazing because I would guess that this guy's not really an amazing stunt fighter, you know. But they always find a way to like, oh, we're going to do this all in CG, or oh, we're going to do this all in some kind of cel-shaded animation, or oh, we're going to do it in stop motion, essentially, to where they sell the action and the suave and sophistication, but they don't have to have this guy like jumping around and doing, you know, Yoda from Attack of the Clone stuff. And I just, you know, just really amazed at how they're able to visualize so economically these, like, distilled these things to where it's like you instantly understand what you're supposed to understand in a very minimalist way. It's just like, you know, how do you tell the story of Lenny losing a child that you haven't even introduced yet in 5 minutes mm-hmm. in the last act of right. of the last, you know, before the last segment of the show, and it lands like it's, you know, but Noah Holland's team's really good.
You just made me wonder if that is a lasting thing with her. Until this moment, I thought, no, that was all part of an illusion. But is the child really gone? I guess so, huh?
I think it really happened.
That's interesting, because clearly what he's doing to David is not real.
Right.
What he's doing.
Or
well,
Sid.
I don't know that he didn't take Dave. They didn't take David back to a Nazi prison, because they could do that, right? They're time travelers.
But it seemed like they were posing as,
I think they were posing,
people from,
like,
their lives. Like the Sydney mm-hmm. from the past wasn't real, although
right, for sure.
She did act the way that you would think Sydney really would act, so they could somehow pull for the right elements to make it seem real. But yeah, it's not clear whether that happened to Lenny. But now I kind of actually think, well, oh, I guess we'll see. But yeah.
So, because that's the other thing is, like, most of the family members back, or no? Maybe all the ones that we see die or turn to pile ashes are actually dead, but mm-hmm. there's just a lot more hiding out in nooks and crannies, like Switch was doing.
Right.
Because at the end of the episode, you know, after he's, you know, vanquished the time demons and threatened them to never come back or I'll kill them all, the house wasn't empty. There were still those acolytes, you know, some of them around anyway, for him to, like, you know, have in contempt.
I mean, and you're talking about Farouk and how badass he was. And, you know, second time through, I was watching that to see, you know, how big of an impact he actually had. And really, all said and done, he killed a couple of them, but it was David who solved the problem. Because true. When David showed his power, which I thought was a great, like, he actually spends half of the episode walking towards the two of them and getting pushed back, because you see that about halfway through, and then the next time we see him again, he's still doing it. Mm-hmm. I think it's really funny. But then he's like, fuck this, and he creates duplicates of himself and mentions something about being a god, and then he splays his multiple arms out like Ganesh, and then he just bursts one of them into flames and then tells the other one, you better go tell your friends to knock it off or you're all dead. And I think that's really what solved it. And then we saw that Sid was about to be raped by one of them, and the other one came and called him off. So I think David actually is the one who solved it.
It's the power of the 10-finger flip off.
Yeah.
You can't withstand
eight arms, man.
I thought it was interesting because there was a little bit of like Doctor Strange visuals. Like the time cycle reminded me of the Dormammu, I'm here to bargain. And then when I believe there's a scene, maybe it's in the Infinity War, where Doctor Strange manifests the Ganesh arms. And I was wondering if, like, there's a little bit, because like that's by far the trippiest of all the Marvel Cinematic Universe installments, Doctor Strange. And I got to think that Noah Hawley saw some of that and thought, oh, you know, that piece of the palette would work well in Legion.
Mm-hmm.
It did too.
Worked for me.
Mm-hmm. Is it my turn?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So my number two, just going over some of the mechanics of the time demons, what they can do and why they're doing it, all these temporal glitches. So we have time repeating, where people will just repeat themselves. And it seems like after a few times, they might sort of realize, hey, didn't we just say that? There's time skipping, which is interesting because it can just be for one person, like with girl Carrie at the beginning. She suddenly appeared with Sid and didn't know, and Sid's like, so you're saying there's a problem with time. So Sid experienced it, but it skipped with Carrie, and then we're like, well, did it happen for Carrie? And she just doesn't remember. You know, it's kind of weird. But I think best not to think too hard about it. What else? There's things aging fast. There's computer records across the globe corrupt with time code errors. So that sounds like it's global, which makes me wonder if shit like this happened to everyone all over the world. And if so, will there be any like fallout from that, or will they just kind of ignore it? There's moments of time that actually get removed, it sounds like male Carrie, the time when he got brainwashed is gone now, so now he's no longer brainwashed. That was convenient. There's freezing time in a localized space that if you go near or touch it, you will freeze too, which I thought was kind of fun. There's the whole thing about the time demons mimicking people from your life at different points in time, or whatever the hell that was. Sid's younger self, David's mother, Lenny's unborn child. I thought the whole thing with the time demon almost raping Sid was actually mimicking David with her, right? A horrific moment from her life, because in hindsight she realized that was a rape, but in the moment she didn't know because she was not in her right mind. So I thought, and that was a really traumatic moment for her. So I thought, I mean, that whole thing is so sick. They can make you really vulnerable because they're pulling from really intimate moments or, you know, talking to your younger self, and then it's a trick. So it was, and I love that they just laugh about it. Like they're so amused at all these things that to everyone else are really violating and horrific, and it's just really twisted. Yeah,
it's interesting because I didn't interpret that as them attempting to rape her. I thought it was more akin of like they were preparing to eat her time, like they were going to turn her into a pile of dust and consume her consume her history and all that. But it's also, it's an interesting concept to think that, yes, since we know they can see obviously everyone's past and know exactly what to torment them with, that they, you know, had seen all these upsetting sexual encounters that she's had and were making her relive it. Maybe that's also part of what they do when they eat your time, too. Mm. They sift through and all the painful morsels they make you re-experience, right, as they're doing it.
Did that occur to you at all, Rima, that it was a re-experiencing of that moment?
Well, you mean like with the time demons impersonating her sister, or not her sister, but herself?
No, the part where the one jumped on top of her.
I don't really, like, I don't understand what it was trying to do to her.
It just, because they had just shown, I think, recent, close to that moment, I think, anyway, if I remember right, they showed the moment where David erased her memory because she'd just been talking to her younger self. And that was when she equated that with the guy turning her around in the shower, aka not a love move, but exerting power. And then they showed her in the same position that she was in, lying on her back when David had sex with her and kind of pushed himself on her. So I thought, that's why I thought that.
Well, there was that, but they also showed in season two when David was manipulating, after he had manipulated her and he was having sex with her, she was on top, showed it on the video camera.
Oh.
So I don't, that's kind of where I get stuck at, because I'm like, well, that for me, what I remember was not like the same position, but. Yeah. But I mean, it doesn't mean that that's not what they were trying to kind of imply there, since that was kind of what was in her mind at the time. Whenever, because I didn't really fully understand what the hell it was doing. I was like, what is this thing going to do to her? Is it going to eat her? Is it going to eat the time? Or
it just felt like a sexual violation to me. But
yeah,
I don't know. So then, more stuff about the demons. Are they malevolent? Let me think about that for a second. Calculating. Just kidding. So, that was a good moment. And it seems pretty obvious that they are malevolent, right? They sure seem like it. They're laughing at everyone and fucking with everyone. And then Shadow King said to think of them like termites that were underground, but David let them out. And Sid says time is collapsing and pretty soon none of us will be anything at all. So it just sounds like they're doing, you know, damage to time. And then why? Switch calls them predators and that they live in the space outside of time, which I think is the same thing as, what did Shadow King call it?
Time outside of time. So I want to go back to the whole if they're malevolent or not, because they're also referred to as predators, and predators are not moral or amoral or immoral. They just are. And one of the things predators do is keep natural populations in check. And since it seems pretty clear that they're being summoned because of an abuse of the time stream, I wonder if what you could what they're doing you actually could describe as malevolent. It could be that they are, you know, here's a person who is abusing their power to control the time stream, so we're going to prune it to keep the overall health of the, you know, space-time continuum. Like, I mean, that's a pull directly from my ass, but it's I don't know. I mean, they're clearly intelligent. They clearly are intelligent, but whether they're doing this because they're just by nature evil, or this is some kind of like natural law kind of check and balance thing, is what I'm kind of interested to see.
Yeah. I mean,
they seem like tricksters to me.
Yeah, they're giggling, and you know, animal predators are exactly what you said, but I don't think that's exclusive. I think, you know, you could consider a serial killer also a predator.
Has it occurred to you that these guys might be like, because the Shadow King seems unusually familiar with these guys and time travel in general, and the relative ease he had of like finding the time traveler and talking to her. I wonder if like this is like a Smeagol Shelob type of situation,
right?
Where he's essentially set a trap and full knowing full well what he's doing, just like, you know, Gollum was trying to lead Sam and Frodo through a shortcut, right? It just how happens that shortcut has a horrific demonic spider that lives in it. I wonder if he knows exactly, you know, like he's put this thing in motion knowing exactly what David would try to do, and this is kind of his end game all along.
Yeah, absolutely.
It could be. I mean, I think it doesn't necessarily have to be that way, but it definitely could be. Man, I can't believe last week I said maybe they dropped the ball and weren't going to show these guys again. I had such little faith. I mean, I think either way, I'm okay with it. I don't need it to be that way. And even if, let's say it's just that, you know, they used Switch's power too much and let these things out and they're just another bad guy, and the Shadow King realized, well, hey, if they destroy everything, then that's not going to be very good for me, so I'm going to help with this and then go back to my plan. It could be that, or it could be what you just said, where he's actually orchestrating the whole thing. You know? But we do know that her power caused it, and she basically is a conduit to let these things out. And I think it's a little unbelievable that she didn't even mention them to David. He says, like, okay, in the future, if there are time demons, tell me about the time demons. And I'm like, yeah, you got a good point there.
But I thought she had.
I don't know, man. I don't remember her ever saying anything about it. That's one of the reasons why I thought they dropped the ball on it, actually.
Well, so here's my theory, is that, like, David has been using her because, like, here's this one point where she's protesting, like, look, I can't do this. All my teeth are loose, and he's like, oh, you're not going to lose your teeth. She's like, but yeah, but they're already all loose. And he's like, look, don't make me force
you, yeah.
And then she's like, what? And I wonder, because we saw how he treated Carrie, it might just be that, like, he's like, oh, you're a time traveler, cool, and then he just started instantly co-opting and started, you know, and he's not interested in her explanations of her powers and its limitations.
Yeah.
He's using her like a switch, like a light switch. You don't give a shit about, you know, every time you every time you turn your lights on at home, Jason and Reem, I don't know if you know this, but you're wearing your switch out, and these things are rated for 10,000, 100,000 switches. Do you care? Because when it breaks, you just replace it and get a new one. And I think I actually just backed into an interesting piece of analysis. You're welcome. Her name is Switch is kind of like that. She is just like this. He sees her as just like tool or conduit, and he's just going to use her the way you would a switch and not care about whether she's getting worn out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but the whether or not her teeth all fall out is different than whether or not these time demons escape and destroy all reality. I mean, it's sort of similar, because he's like, I don't care about the details.
Yeah.
But you'd think she might go, no, this one's really important. At least try to mention it.
But I wonder, like, how many times she's tried to explain to him the rules of time travel, and he's just, just open up the thing. Right, and also, like, she seemed kind of ambivalent about whether she should be following David, and, you know, she decided to side with him over the Shadow King, because at least David's a man, whatever the hell that means. And now we see that she's sufficiently scared of David, and I think maybe it's because the whole, like, you're going to force me to what now? That she kind of jumped on Carrie's offer to rescue her like a drowning person. Like, it actually shocked me that she just, like, instantly put aside a toothbrush and, like, yes, I'm coming with you.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and if, I was sort of wondering, is she doing that because she has decided David's not the best one to be with? Or is it because maybe she thought Carrie could help with the whole time demon problem? But no, I think the implication was she was ready to get away from him. And that's the big thing at the end. I mean, it looks like the time demon problem is solved. Maybe we'll see, but it looks like it. But now the problem is that Carrie took Switch and David says war. So that's where we are. But I still feel like we don't totally... I feel like there's more revelations to come with Switch, why she was there in the first place, and what's going on with her.
Can I level a slight criticism of this season?
Yeah, of course.
I feel like they jumped the gun with the rage juice. Like, you know, they showed the blue turn into red, and that was supposed to be a thing that felt like a turning point, and it really wasn't, because we're back to the blue happy juice. Like, if he had said war, and then those tubes had turned red, and the you know, his people started getting... I don't know. I guess he needed to... Maybe that's the Chekhov's rage juice, because he did that before he led that commando team with knives to go steal Carrie in the first place. So maybe you're supposed to understand that, like... The next time the red juice flows, it's gonna be for war, not just for like a surgical strike. So maybe I'll retract that slight criticism.
Still got 4 episodes to go.
Chekhov's rage juice.
Yes,
that's the title of next week's episode, by the way. So.
Chekhov's giant psychic pig teat.
Okay, Rima, number one.
Oh gosh, my number one is simply war. Because it looks like that's kind of where we're headed, either in the next episode or episodes to come, whenever they decide.
4 more left.
Four more left. So I feel like it's coming. And, you know, when David comes back from his little mental prison, visiting who he thinks is his mom, but was just one of those time demons instead, you know, he finds that Carrie has left and has, I guess, rescued Switch and gone back to Division 3. And I've mentioned it before that I don't really know how much Switch was devoted to David. Like, is she helping him freely? Was she under like a similar type of control like his other accolades? We did see how she kind of got in part, like in the beginning of the episode when he puts his fingers to his temple and puts everyone kind of in their drug
bliss
haze
mode,
and their bliss mode. She was in there with him or with all of them as well. So but it seemed like she was pretty willing. I thought, well, it seemed like she's willing and she's not under so much control. Like, she, for some reason, I thought was compelled to help him.
Yeah, I think because she spends so much time trying to persuade her or, no, come on. That, to me, says that the idea is that at least up till now, he's not mentally forcing her, you know?
That's true, because why would he have to say that if she was under his control? But, you know, anyway, she does end up leaving with Carrie, and I'm guessing it's because she has seen the side of David where he's very much, like, not really caring about her and the toll that it takes on her. Because you saw in the last episode, remember how, like, exhausted she was when they fell out of the door and they're in the hallway, and she just, you know, he kept pushing her, like, we gotta go back. She's like, no, I can't. You know, she was just, like physically exhausted or whatever it was that was happening to her, having to be there for so long and keep going back. I don't know if she's just now kind of seeing, you know, him for who he is. Maybe it's the God complex that's kind of freaking her out. I don't know. But then we had Lenny in the beginning talking about leaving with her girlfriend and with the baby. So she also seems to be becoming disenchanted with David and his plans. So, you know, all she wants is a safe place for her family, and she's kind of getting tired of David. I think, Jason, you mentioned that earlier. So David, you know, kind of snaps out of where he was at to see all of this kind of crumbling around him, and now he's, I think, ready to take on Division III, and I think everyone should be a little bit worried. So,
Yeah, I mean, and everybody should, like, Lenny's right to be worried, because David doesn't even care about his own mommy insofar as that she, as long as she protects him from, that's the only thing he really cares about, because as his mom says, like, well, if you have access to these powers, stop this, like, bring back the dead, do this. And it's interesting because, like, it's kind of, it's interesting, this whole concept of being time travel and, like, you know, you go back and you stop some great evil, but, like, why would you ever stop there? It's like, okay, you're going to stop World War II, but, like, 60 million people died in World War I. You want to go back and stop that? What about the Civil War? What about the Hundred Years' War? What about, you know, it's like the idea that the human wickedness is an almost infinite quantity that you can't. I felt the same way a little bit about the Avengers movie. I already got yelled at for spoiling that last week. So, but the idea of, like, anytime you use time travel to right a certain wrong, there's literally billions of dead being like, what about me, dude? Am I not, you know, am I not important enough to bring back? I thought those are interesting, but it just shows that David doesn't really even care about his own mother. All she is to him is, you know, the vessel that gave him life and that failed to protect him. And he doesn't. So if he doesn't care about his own mother to save her from any kind of trauma or pain, why would he do that for Lenny? Why would he do that for Switch? Why would he do that for Sid?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Good point.
Okay. My turn. So let's see, where should I go? I liked the whole sequence with Sid and her younger self. For one thing, I've kind of been missing Rachel Keller this season, because last season was all about the romance of Rachel and David, and, you know, even before, it just, her character hasn't gotten as much to do lately, so it was nice to see this scene, even though it deepened and made us understand her a little bit more, but it did also feel kind of like a repeat. But still, I like the idea of her meeting her younger self. We know that she had kind of a rough childhood because of her power and everything. And so it would make sense, like, if I saw my younger self, I would want to do what she did, which is try to give her some perspective, you know, that's come with age, some perspective and wisdom. So it was nice to see her do that, even though it turned out to be all based on nothing. I mean, it wasn't real as far as we could tell. And self-awareness, you know, give her some self-awareness that comes with getting a little bit older. Young Sid keeps kind of gravitating towards, well, we should just go to a desert island, we should just be alone. But older Sid is like, yeah, well, it's, you know, even though I loved and it didn't turn out well, it was worth it and I don't want to give up. So she's trying to instill some positivity and hope there. And that when Sid is asking, when young Sid is asking, does it get better? Do we get married? I almost wondered if at that point it was getting to some malevolence, like kind of poking at her. I mean, I don't know. It does seem like the kind of thing a younger version would ask, but it also is the kind of thing time demons would ask just to get at somebody.
Yep.
So hard to tell there. But we get more perspective on Sid's experience, the whole thing about how when she uses her power, she feels like she disappears. And then when she comes back to her body, there's a funny smell there. And just this whole sense of violation, which is sort of ironic because as she's saying that, she's also being violated because the circumstances aren't what she thinks they are. And then this whole time that they're talking, we already saw, at least for the second half of it, we already knew that David had talked to what he thought was his mother, but that wasn't real. And I love how that was revealed. He knew because Gabrielle's smile turned demonic, almost, you know, exaggerated. And that is creepy to me when somebody smiles like that. And that's when he said, nope, lies. But then we go back to older Sid and younger Sid, and they're having this really intimate, sweet conversation. And I'm like, I guess I was still thinking or hoping that it was real, but then it was revealed that it wasn't during this hug, which is really sick, right? At least that's what I got. Younger Sid started holding on way too tight. Mm-hmm. And she's like, what the hell's going on here? So that was a really creepy moment. I mean, this whole episode, I feel like it was the scariest, creepiest episode of Legion up until now, with these time demons reaching through screens and all the things, Rima, that you already said about them. They just found some good ways of seriously making it creepy, which I think is really impressive. But anyway, the whole thing about tricking someone into these intimate situations and then revealing that, no, it was a demon there, that was probably the creepiest thing.
Yep.
All right. We're all through our points, right? Time for any notes? Did I skip anybody?
Did we get Aaron's number one?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go for it.
That's all right. I want to talk about the sequence, the time between time sequence, because it's interesting. You asked me before we started recording a podcast whether my regular co-host Jim is keeping up with Legion. And it's funny because I asked him the same thing this morning, because I thought this is the episode, if he had, that might have broken him, because he has a very low tolerance for what he refers to as like David Lynch bullshit. which is just like kind of like being an auteur for the sake of auteur, or weird for the sake of weird. And I like David Lynch bullshit, because I don't think it's that at all. I think he's trying to evoke a particular feeling, like what it's like to be stuck in a nightmare. And
it's dream logic, usually. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And this was a perfect example of that. The way you know, how do you show the time between time? You do it in kind of like the stop motion with this like weird, you know, kind of old timey sepia filter with it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you do like almost like silent movie type title cards. And I just thought it was so weird and such another great way to visualize a space that's not real, like the astral plane, but it looks completely distinct and different from the things we've seen in the astral plane before. So, you know, in a show that's like used so many different visual metaphors to express so many different levels of unreality, the fact that they had one more tool in the toolbox, I thought was incredible. Mm-hmm. And that sequence was, honestly, it's some of the best action they've shot in this show, because it was all implied. It was all kind of in your imagination. They just showed you something like the Shadow King drawing a sword out of his mouth and, you know, him kind of stop motioning, slice him in half. And it's really, really cool. And it's the reason I love this show.
Yeah. That whole sequence was so great. And it reminded me a lot of the scene with Lenny in season one, where she's like fully taken over by the Shadow King. And it's like in black and white, and it's kind of like a silent film, and it shows like the dialogue on the cards on the screen, and and they're talking, but you can't hear them. So it reminded me a lot of that. I mean, it was different, clearly, but you know, just kind of how they use this visual to kind of explain what's happening in the moment. I think it's just brilliant.
And they called it the time between time, and Shadow King said that time demons should have no advantage there.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the idea behind that was everybody's blippy here. You know, the time demons are like that in our dimension, but in this dimension, we all have that, I guess.
It was interesting. You mentioned the blipping. The time demons were blipping. They were kind of blipping in this time between time. And then like future Sid was blipping. To some degree in season two. You guys remember that much? Future Sid?
Oh, yeah. Kind of like a digital, or like a skipping record almost, or something.
Yeah, it wasn't as pronounced. Like broken. Yeah, yeah, but but she was, you could definitely kind of tell the difference how she got kind of glitchy and a little blippy when she was like talking either with David or Farouk.
Huh. So, that's really cool. So it's like they found a way to extend the existing visual metaphor, of like, you know, time and the normal flow of time being interrupted or messed with.
And I liked in that scene, wasn't there somebody threw something? Was it one of the time demons? And it almost hit Clark, and he moved to the side and opened his mouth, and it.
Yep.
Yeah.
It was Carrie threw a spear at, and the time demon dodged it, and he just barely he opened his mouth
wide enough to.
Yeah. And when Farouk is like eating something, they're like sitting around this campfire or something, mm-hmm. and he's eating something, and he offers it to Clark, and he just kind of waves his hand at like, no things.
It was that slice of dead beast he carved out that carcass, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. It looked like something out of old Star Trek.
Yeah.
That whole sequence. Okay, let's get on to notes. Rima, got any notes?
Just a few notes. Already mentioned the giant toothbrush. I love those sometimes ridiculous things that they put in here, and it's somehow for the show it just makes sense. Like last season with the big giant bathtub plug,
right? The drain.
In the drain. They had the giant toothbrush that Switch had. Did you guys catch the shield scene?
Yes. It's one of the things I want to talk about.
Yes, so I thought good. That was so great. I was like, wait, what? What's going on? I thought that was just absolutely brilliant to put in there.
Especially because that is FX's first big breakout original programming hit back in the 2000s. And so I felt like that was messing, like the Time Demons are, and I still maintain whether they're under Shadow King's control or not, they just seem malevolent to me. And they're messing with all the characters in this episode. And that was them messing with us because partway through you hear them laughing.
Mm-hmm.
It was it's like it's also DVR bait, as I discovered, because I'm like, what the hell? I thought I fast forward, I gotta rewind. No, that is the start of the scene. Can we talk about the meta of it though? Because that's the Vic Mackey introducing himself as a different kind of cop. He's not a good cop, he's not a bad cop.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if this is some kind of hint of, you know, we're talking about David being irredeemable, and I think that's broadly true, but we also know that the Shadow King is a millennial old psychic demon himself and will happily bending himself to take over the world in David's absence. I wonder if you're supposed to understand that, like, David is kind of a Vic Mackey, and he will not be able to redeem himself nor save himself, but it might be something like a pot, like he takes out the Shadow King with himself. So like he's mm-hmm. he dies an anti-hero.
Yeah, I could see that.
Because sometimes you need a monster to take out something else monstrous, mm-hmm. and you know, like right. that's the whole idea of the shield. You know that particular unit in the LA is that you know they're trying to go against gang violence and the drug trade and trafficking and all this stuff, and you got to play outside the
go
rules.
Go to the dark places.
Exactly. I wonder if they're trying to say that on a meta level with about David and hint for his future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
Also, this reminds me, just that little segment, there was this game on the Nintendo GameCube called Eternal Darkness. Did either of you play that?
No.
It was great because you're going on this kind of Indiana Jones-like quest and you go into these dark tombs, but the ghoulies and monsters there drive you insane. And if your sanity meter goes down too low, then weird things start to happen, like the screen will get fuzzy and then it'll say that your controller's disconnected or you know, it'll show part of a TV show or something and you're like, what the fuck? And so it's really effective. I love that game. Never seen anything like it before or since.
That's cool.
Okay, what else, Rima?
Just wanted to kind of, while you were talking about that scene with Sid, I really liked how we got a little bit of a deeper dive into her describing her powers. I don't think we've seen that too much since like season one. And when she was talking about the exchange of bodies, like when she does, you know, switch bodies with someone else, the way that she says it, she's describing it like a sexual assault, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that could be on her and maybe even that other person that she switches with. Because she says people get too close, they touch you and you disappear, and then they're inside in your belly and in your head. And when you get back, there's a smell. Someone else's smell is inside your nose. And you check out. You tell people, it's fine. I don't own my body. You say, my power is like a vacation. I get to be a tourist in someone else's life. Who cares if every time I come home, I feel dirty? I just thought that was just kind of heartbreaking to kind of see how she describes it. And I like that we also got, I guess because this time demon was representing her younger self, I still felt like we got a little bit of a perspective from the young Sid's view of that interaction that happened.
Me too. And I think it was actually real too. I mean, not the real young Sid, but somehow they pulled from
her memories. I thought that was interesting because we had adult Sid's, you know, description and what happened and from her perspective, you know, and then, you know, we got to see that whole sequence, but hearing it from young Sid and how she was just looking for a connection with someone and ended up experiencing the loss of her virginity in, you know, kind of an aggressive kind of way.
The story we heard last year was that Sid, heard her stepdad or her mom's boyfriend in the shower and switched bodies with her mom and then entered the shower to have sex with the boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, her power switched back in the middle and her mom confronted them and, you know, all hell broke loose. The way she described it this way is like maybe that the because that all sounded kind of consensual, weird, but like consensual from Sid's standpoint. But the way her young self explained it, it made me wonder if what had actually happened is she switched back in her body. The boyfriend realized it and then turned her around and continued, you know, the sexual encounter.
We should go back and watch, but I'm pretty sure when they were in the shower and he got sexually aroused by her, and I think I remember thinking he sensed something different about her and that turned him on. I think he turned her around right then.
I think, I think it was.
Back and watch. Because right, I think as soon as the body shifted, you heard him go, "What the hell?" He was shocked. Yeah.
I think the way that she told it was pretty accurate as far as, when it began, he turns her around and I guess puts her face in the glass.
Yeah, I don't think it was about him forcing himself on her. It was just simply about that act of not being face to face with her. And she thought that was weird and didn't feel good or something.
Right.
Well, and I think that she doesn't have any existing framework for what to expect or what is really going to happen. I think it's probably going to be more of a lovemaking and special and intimate, and instead it kind of turns into this aggressive, which is fine because, you know, if you've got two adults who are having sex and, you know, and she, her, you know, her mom seemed to enjoy, you know, men, it seemed, I feel like she's probably very, you know, a very sexual person and for seriously, when you're in the shower anyway, you can't face to face is like impossible. Sorry, you have to.
Can you give us a little more detail?
Speaking practical, offline maybe. Okay. I'm not going on the record, but I mean it's kind of practical anyway. But she doesn't know that. She doesn't have an existing framework.
Because you're right. Like this whole thing about Sid describing her power is in the language of sexual assault and violation, and you realize that Sid her whole life has just had all these experiences where it feels dirty and like violation, and so the thing with David is just another one in a string of those, and it's, you know, probably worse in a lot of ways, but she's probably sensitive to it, you know, like I don't want to feel like that.
I think that's why she turned on him really quick.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Because of all of her, you know, what she's been through and that traumatic event. And that's why she's so keen to keep people away from her and to, you know, far as touching and stuff.
She feels violated.
Yeah. And then when she experienced that with David, she was quick, you know, to kind of turn on him.
Yeah, so you actually imparted it better than I did in my point, but that's why I like this segment, probably, or at least one of the reasons why I really liked it, is it just gave you more of a sense of why in season one, when you first meet Sid, she just does not want to fucking be touched, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not just because of the power, it's because of this feeling of being violated.
Absolutely. So the only other note that I had was, I think it was mentioned earlier, was when Sid said that she said it was worth falling in love with David, even after all the bad that was happened. I liked hearing that there was still some positivity there.
Yeah, that's what's remarkable. Even after all this, she still wants to try.
Yeah.
I mean, she's appreciating what was good about what happened with her and David, and she doesn't want to give up on the possibility that she could have intimacy again.
Yeah. Sure.
Yep, and that's kind of all of us. I mean, it's the older you get, the more you'll have some shitty experiences and want to close yourself off, and you have to talk yourself into opening up again.
I think it'd be the opposite, though, too. Like, the older you get, the more experience you get with loss and pain, the more it's like you get a faith. Well, this is one way it can go. Mm-hmm. If you have love and support and access to decent mental health resources. But, like, you can also get increasing confidence in, like, you know what? I don't have to be as guarded with my heart and my feelings, because I know I can experience pain and loss, and I can hurt, and I can also heal and get stronger and get better that way too.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah.
Thanks for reminding me of that.
Huh. Reminding myself, brother.
Okay. Any notes, Aaron?
Three words: lunar agriculture colonies. They are real. They exist, and Ptolemy apparently is overseeing them. I want to see these lunar agriculture colonies that are being overseen by this guy.
No,
he's landing jumbo jets too.
Yeah, it's just true. It's like, you know, one of these things is not like the others. He's also supervising a kindergarten class finger painting. It's like, okay, you're all over the place, dude. We've speculated a lot about David's lunchboxes. And I thought it was interesting that they made a point to show the demons, like, eating them almost with, like, relish. Like, it's like, you know, like, you can't stop with just one. Any ideas what these... Was there any there? Is there, like, they're trying to imply something?
I actually have not thought about them that much, but right now, just thinking about it, it just seems like another sort of metaphorical symbol of him being full of himself, to the point that he needs a lunchbox.
It just seemed like pointedly that was the end result of whatever manufacturing process he was doing, or like that was the end product being built from all of this, you know, love bombing, and the fact that it was destroyed utterly. And now he's got the, you know, he's declared war. I wonder, I don't know, like, you know, that everything is so rich and the visual storytelling. I just conditioned by Holly. He rings the bell and I start drooling. So
I don't know
what's up with the lunchboxes, and what does it mean when the demons ate them?
I don't know. But
interesting.
I'll be honest. I don't think I've taken that deep of a dive into them. I've noticed them only long enough to know that I want one.
it's that's commoditizing. That's what lunchboxes represent to me. It's to the point where something that used to be genuinely special becomes commoditized, and it's still cool and you want one, but it's a little bit further along in the life cycle of something. I don't know. Yeah, we should keep an eye on that.
All right, that's all the points I had.
Okay, I just had a couple. When Carrie was like, remember when we used to have fun, and Ptolemy's like, I remember details, facts. I just thought, man, he's worse than Bran. That was the first thing I thought. And then I noticed Mail Carrie calls him Sir. And so it makes it feel like he's in charge now, which is a shift in the hierarchy.
Well, because he seems like he's kind of taking the place of General Fukuyami, right? Yeah. So that was kind of the boss or head of Division 3, I thought. So
yeah, maybe he's like, take, because he comes from the mainframe or whatever, so he's more than
he
just,
is the mainframe, right?
Yeah, he is the mainframe. Exactly. I noticed Female Carrie seems to be taking Male Carrie's disappearance in stride. She misses him, but she's not flipping out like she would have in season one. So I guess I don't know if it's still reversed where he goes into her versus the opposite now, but it feels to me like now they're actually just two separate people. And so she's gotten time to get used to being without him.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible. It's also possible that that particular actor has a limited range and is not the greatest at emoting whatever she's supposed to be emoting.
Well, yeah, I guess so. But the fact is that, you know, in season one, when they were in the mental asylum, that Shadow King kind of dragged all their minds into it, and erased their memories, so they thought they were all mental patients, and she was really attached to him there. And then, you know, throughout the series, it's been clear that they're, like, especially when they did switch places, she had a hard time adjusting to that. So now she's mm-hmm. just sort of like, I'm bored. Anyway, I guess that's it. Yeah, that's all the notes. We've covered everything. So we'll take a little break. There's more to come. Stay with us. Back, it's time for some news.
All right, so we have one item this week. This is from The Wrap. It's an interview with Noah Hawley. I thought this was kind of fun. So if you notice, coming back from a commercial break on Monday's Legion, which randomly pivoted to a scene from the former FX series, which sees Mackie walk into his boss's office with the pre-widescreen era aspect ratio with letterbox on the sides before abruptly going back to Legion. Showrunner Noah Hawley explained that since the episode messes with time, with multiple sudden time loops and time jumps, he wanted to give the audience the same feeling as the character. He says, I think it's really interesting to see how the characters are dealing with time travel, but I also want to give the audience the experience of time travel. When we go back to the show, it's literally like you've traveled through time in a way that makes it much more visceral. As Switch describes the time demons, these beings exist outside in the space outside of time, and once they get let in, they are literally eating time. This causes time to speed up, loop around, and in some cases erase things from existence. In one heartbreaking example, Lenny experiences the entire lifespan of her daughter in a matter of minutes while Lenny doesn't age. Whenever you tell a time travel story, there's always consequences, and obviously those consequences for us are a bit more literal, Hawley continued. I think there's an idea that something is protecting the time stream, and if you if everything is carefully balanced, and if you mess up the balance, you start to let things out that shouldn't be let out.
That's cool. It almost like implies that, like, we're not just messing with us, but the fact that we momentarily went back in time to where the shield was airing in standard definition.
Yeah.
I like that. That's cool.
Yeah. I love stuff like that. Anything meta.
Yeah, that was super cool. He's just great. Brilliant. I worship at the altar of Noah Hawley.
All right. Thank you. Let's move on to mental notes. We have one email. Aaron?
It is from Jamie Henry, and they say, this episode gave me some unexpected and highly enjoyable pairings and groupings. Carrie and Switch, Carrie, Clark, and Farouk, Sid, and past Sid. Sid talking with her past self was beautiful. Who hasn't wanted the opportunity to talk to the younger self with all the experience they have now? Those were some of my favorite scenes until they weren't. Way to re-traumatize Sid and the rest of us, Noah Hawley. He has certainly been delivering the nightmare fuel this season. I don't think anything could be more disturbing to me than the no-face baby of last week, but the time meter's pretty close. Why did they have to have teeth? There is nothing like this show on TV right now, and I love it and the ride it takes me on, nightmares and all. Talk to you guys next week.
Nice. Okay, what's one thing that you would tell your teenage self?
Me?
Anybody.
One day you will be paid to watch Star Wars.
Congratulations.
So hang in there, kid.
The dream is coming.
It's all going to pay off. Being a nerd is worth it.
Yep.
All right, that is our show, episode 23. Thanks for listening, everyone. We're halfway through the final season, 4 more episodes, and that's going to be it.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe we're almost there.
Yeah, halfway it's been point. Great, too. It's been a great season, don't you guys think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it.
It's been really good.
I love the feel. I love it when you're watching the last season of a show and you just know they're just like not leaving anything, any ammunition in the can. It's all getting expended.
Right. I wish there would be a last season of a couple other shows I can think of like that.
Yep.
Okay. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email or send a voice message to us at legion@podcastica.com.
You can find us on the web at facebook.com/legionpod.
And be sure to check out our other shows at baldmove.com and podcastica.com.
Woo! All right. Hey. That's our show.
Thanks for listening.
All right, that's our show.
Thanks for listening.
All right. Ya.